From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan, or on demand as a podcast. It's Friday, December 1st. Yeah, first Friday. I'm your host, Andy Klein. Thanks for joining me for the conversation, which today is going to be a lot about First Friday. It's the first Friday of the month. That's the one that started it all, Gallery Walk. And that's just starting to gear up, and the weather is going to cooperate. So it should be a great evening in celebration of Gallery Walk. We're going to be talking to three artists who are all featured at the Jack tonight and for all this month with the theme Alaska Ink. Also today, a preview of the big holiday extravaganza that is the Nutcracker from Juno Dance Theater, which opens tonight as well. It's all ahead today. Hope you'll join me. We'll also have a rundown of everything that's going on for Gallery Walk. And again, as I said, weather's looking great for Gallery Walk, just some overcast skies, and that's getting clearer tonight. Temperatures in the about the 20s for the highs, and then sunny skies for this weekend with temps in the 20s and some snow flurries possible on Sunday. Stay tuned.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na khaya ha an ka.
This is Juno Afternoon, your community-supported public media station, KTOO, and I'm Andy Klein, and boy, what a fun day this always is every year, Gallery Walk, and today's one of the good ones because the weather's going to be beautiful. It's going to be super kind of just getting a little, maybe a little bit of snow flurries in the air, and we've got three folks here, all artists, who are going to be part of the Alaska Ink feature that's happening over at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, the Jack. That's all going all this month, but it's also featuring a whole bunch of people, but we've got three folks here right now that we're going to be talking to. Fumi Matsumoto is here. Fumi, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for asking.
And yes, Jessica Hanlon is here.
Hi.
Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
And Jim Human's here as well. Jim, how are you?
Thank you, Andy.
It's great to see all of you, and I'm really excited about seeing and hearing about the work that you're doing, and what a cool idea, Alaska Ink. Jim, I'll just ask you to start with, maybe just talk about the theme a little bit here. And then we got lots of time here. We'll be able to talk to each of you about your individual work as well. But what's talking about the theme of Alaska Ink?
Well, I think the theme is to show local printmakers. We did a similar show in 2018. We had nine artists, five of which are in this show. And we're happy to say we have five new members, so participants. We're a loose organization of a lot of people who share a love for printmaking.
Loose but powerful.
Oh, we'd like to think,
right?
So.
You know, yes. But so and then Fumi, tell me a little bit. You've been here a few times and talked about your work. When you thought about doing it this year, is there a different approach, a new approach? What sort of approach did you take this year?
Oh well. Yes, definitely. If you're familiar with my past print work, and also I did ceramics and a few sculptures at a show at Jack, but that was a few years ago. The last show that we had, you know, like Jim said, 2018, we did have a lot of interesting prints. Mine were lino woodblock prints, and I can explain, you know, what that is. It's a relief print process where you have a block of wood or linoleum. You cut out the image that you want, and everything you cut off of the block is white. And what's left, the relief design, you print it up with ink, and it turns out to be the image, the black ink. And I was using the strange kind of rubber stuff, that not the hard linoleum, but the soft rubber stuff that you cut, and ink it up with a brayer roller. Just I use water-based ink. And But the interesting thing is that I print not on standard paper, but tea bags.
Yeah.
And they're all recycled tea bags. And people say, do you drink that much tea? I said, well, I drink a lot of tea, but I've had friends and family send me tea bags. I've been collecting them.
You get shipments of used tea bags.
I do. They don't weigh much.
They don't know what to make of you, but it's fine.
But the tea bags are interesting because, you know, you've got square ones, you've got the flow-through ones,
right.
And you've got circular ones. So I use all the different – someone recently gave me – turmeric tea bags, and they're yellow. I don't have one in this show, but it's a different kind of tea bag. And if you see the one block print I did called it's a barn owl, the background, you'll see sort of a brown pattern. And if you look closely, you realize, oh, that's the tea bag, the shape of the tea bag.
Oh,
When you unfold a flow-through bag.
Right.
So
that gets incorporated into the contour and texture of the actual artwork. That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Jessica, I wanted to talk to you a little bit because what's interesting to me about you and your artwork here, is it freeing to just do artwork where you're not also thinking in terms of, is this going to work as far as my business goes? Frost and Fur, of course, is your business that most people in Juneau, I think, are familiar with, and you do beautiful work there. It, of course, is artwork. But I think, is that correct to think that you have to sort of think of two minds when you're working in that area?
100%. Yeah. And I think you put it into words better than I usually can. I think like 90% of my artistic power goes towards effectively manufacturing, like create an image that I think will do well on fabric and then making it, just like recreating it over and over and over again. Effectively, like I said, manufacturing.
Commercial art in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that your work, what I see when I see it on T-shirts and all that, everything and all the different ways you see it, it's always very beautiful. But it's also like I think that you must be thinking in terms of, well, I want to make something that represents where we are so that people will be interested in it. So when they wear it, wherever they might be, it's representational of a journey they took or of something that they love, like fish or something like that. So. And then, tell me a little bit about now you're doing this for the Jack. Did you just decide I'm going to get away from that? Or did you work in some of what you also work with in Frost and Fur?
It's a little bit of a mix of both. So for this specific show, I had done some silk screening on paper. Has its own name. It's called like a serigraph, which is literally just a fancy word for silk screening. I think they started using it in the 60s to sort of separate it from the commercial process of silk screening, just so there was like a different designation. And I had done serigraph work in college and printed band posters for friends and stuff like that. And then I hadn't done paper printing. I had just like jumped into Frost and Fur and done tons of manufacturing. And then for my last watercolor show, I included 3 or 4 serigraphs just as a personal challenge. Like, oh, I haven't done this in 14 years. I want to try.
And is it using the same equipment that you use for t-shirts and things, or is there
50-50.
Modifications?
Yeah. I have a different press that I do it on. It's actually one my dad made me 20 years ago, right after college. He put it together for
That's
me,
cool.
And it's the one I still use. It's a piece of countertop from an old hospital building, and he just it's got like the perfect amount of epoxy on the top, and I love it. And so that's what I print on for paper, and then I use the same screens but a higher mesh count. So like with clothing printing, you want more ink to go through the silk screen. With paper printing, you want less because the substrate isn't absorbed.
Yeah, I was going to ask
absorb.
That was my question, was what the media of printing on paper, is it feel easier or?
No, it's a lot more technical.
It is.
One of the major challenges, like what most the challenge in printmaking, particularly when you're doing things where there's more than one color, is registration. And that's getting everything lined up perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And for this particular project, I decided to turn old watercolors from my most recent show into silkscreen pieces using a really specific printing type of printing called CMYK halftone printing. So basically, I took watercolors. I broke them down into four different screens, blue, red, yellow, and black. And those screens are made up of tiny dots. And layered together, they turn back into my watercolors.
Oh, wow.
So it's just, it was an opportunity to try something totally new and really foreseeing myself out of my normal box that I'm in, and also seeing how far I could make my equipment work for me. And I basically worked it as far as I could.
Were you trying as much as possible to duplicate the look of a watercolor, or yeah. were you saying, I'm going to make a, you know, representation of that in sort of a different style?
No, it's like from 10 feet away, it looks exactly like my watercolor. And oh, up wow. close, it's tiny dots.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so it was just a really great opportunity for myself to just take on a new challenge. And right. that's sort of what I use this opportunity as.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jim, we didn't get to talk about the specific work you're doing. So tell me a little bit about what you've got showing.
Well, I focus primarily on relief prints. I also do etching. And in my relief prints...
Can you describe that, what that means, relief print?
Relief really means the ink goes on the high spot. And in etching, generally, the ink goes on a low spot and you rub off all the ink from the shiny surface. So there's kind of like a photo positive versus photo negative technique.
Right.
I tend to gravitate towards multicolor prints and have the same challenges that Jessica talks about with registration. And it's just so much fun to, you know, it's never going to be exactly what you, it's like playing music. You wish you hit the right note the first time, but it's a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
Some of my prints are what are called reduction prints, which uses a single block for multicolors of ink. And as a result, if you did something like this image with a reduction block, you could only have, if you start out with 20 prints for the first color and do the second color, well, if you make an error, you're down to 19. And you're going to have the challenges that Jessica referenced. And, right. But it's something I've just fallen in love with. And I think as a painter and printmaker, the two things complement each other because you're just coming at it from two different directions. And it forces you to test where you're going to go and learn where you're going to go.
What subject matters do you sort of gravitate towards? Is it natural landscapes, things like that, or is it?
I do landscapes, portraits, animals. I once knew an artist who said when he does a piece of art, he wants to make them smile or ponder. And I guess that's my goal to achieve one of those with each piece.
Right.
So, and perhaps both.
Fumi, we talked a little bit about your technique and the what you're using and also the media that you're printing on. Is that something that you're still, is that like kind of where you are right now as far as your process goes? Or are you thinking about different things? Or tell me a little bit about where you are right now and you're in what you're interested in pursuing.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I only have one print on tea bags in the show. The rest, there are six other prints, are totally different. Their color, for one thing, with the tea bags, they're muted browns and natural color with black image. But these have.
Now, can I stop you there with the tea bags? But you're using regular ink.
Yes.
And just tea bags as the paper. You're not like using tea derived inks or something like that.
No.
But it fits the color scheme of the ink bags, and that's why the tea bags.
Right.
That's why. Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
But I have used tea as an ink. And coffee, but that's a whole different story.
I won't
get into that right now. But what I'm doing now is a process using a gel pad or gel plate. And it's something that I had never really thought about or heard of as an artistic medium. There, apparently in the 1800s, they were using gelatin-based plates for printing.
And what kind of gelatin, like actual, like food-based kind of gelatin?
Well, that's weird. You can make your own. I haven't done that. I have a recipe. That'll come maybe next. But I have a commercial gel plate. It's made out of probably some sort of a plastic. I don't know what, but it has a consistency of finger Jell-O. You know what that is? It's kind of a hard Jell-O. If you put too much Jell-O gelatin in a thing,
does it kind of jiggle a little bit?
A little bit. Not much. No. It's more of like a little rubber pad. Yeah. You know, it bends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's soft. Whereas when you're doing most printmaking, the plates are either the blocks are wood or linoleum or copper.
That's what I can remember when in school doing it, and really you kind of have to really gouge them.
But these plates, you don't gouge them. You don't want to gouge them. What you do is you actually get a roller, I use acrylic. You can use all different kinds of paints, and you just roll it out as a layer onto the jelly pad. And my largest gel pad is I think 8x10, so it's not huge. But anyway, you roll it out. Then I went out and collected all different sorts of plants, botanicals. Just on my walks, I got ferns and grasses, whatever. But anyway, you have your rolled on ink on your gel plate. Then you just lay the flowers or the ferns right on top of the plate, and you put another sheet of paper on the back and you press it down so that when you remove the paper and remove the little plants, you have the image of the plant on the plate. Then you get your paper and you place it on top and rub the back with a baron, which is just a little pad. And then you lift it off and there you've got the botanical colorful print image. And I've used all different colors and also gold, silver. So you've got this incredible, colorful piece of paper that has the image that you want. And then this is where I differ from a lot of other people who do gel prints. I use my wood block or my lino cut blocks of birds and animals. I put that on top of that colorful background. So you've got a black and white image on top of a very colorful background of flowers and ferns and whatever. So it's very unique. I have never seen anyone do
it. Is that a one-time thing? Is it just creates one print and then you're done with that? Or
yes, that's the thing. It's a monoprint.
Oh, okay.
And also, it's not – well, standard printmakers, most printmakers will do an edition, which is like several prints. And when you see a print, it might be numbered like, 20 over 100. That means that it's the 20th print from 100, an edition of 100. Well, mine are monoprints, so it's one of a kind. I mean, I tried reproducing it, but once you've got those plants and flowers impressed on the plate, that's it. I mean, you could put other plants, but you're not ever going to get exactly the same flowers or plants. You're not going to get exactly the same color because you're rolling it on with a roller. And I roll on layers of other colors like, pink or blue or green on top of a base color. And then I'll put white on the back to have it just be a little brighter when you pull it off. But so, each one is individual. You're never going to have one exactly the same. So it's more almost like having a painting rather than a print. Yeah. And mono print just means one print.
Wow, that's fascinating.
So they're unique. Yeah. So if you go and see them, it's not like any of the other prints that you'll see because this will be one of a kind. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
The original is all you got.
But that's the nice part about it. If you've done ceramics and you've done Raku, I kind of compare it to Raku because, you never know exactly what you're going to get.
What is Raku? I don't know that.
Well, that's when you use, you have a piece of greenware you have a piece of pottery, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's been fired once. And it's not greenware, it's bisqueware, sorry. Then you put your glazes on it. And instead of putting it into a standard kiln where you leave it in for hours, and this pot you would put into a Raku kiln, which could be a large one or a small one. It has a burner. It heats up very quickly. And you have to be very careful about the temperature. And when it gets to the right temperature, you take the pot out with tongs And this would be pretty dangerous. I mean, you can lose some eyebrows here. You know, you pull it out and you put it into either a garbage can or some sort of a container that has grass or combustibles, sawdust.
Newspapers sometimes.
Newspapers.
Yep, I have seen.
Right.
Yeah.
And you put the pot in there and put a lid on and you get this reduction. All the smoke comes out. The smoke goes into the glaze and the pot. And what that does is give you these incredible effects. Sometimes you'll get streaks, blotches. It's just
I've seen this with glassworking as well, where they'll take glass hot out of and do the same thing. And like you say, it's incredible. It's obviously one of a kind. It's never going to be able to reproduce that exact type of effect again. And it's really fascinating. Yeah.
And you can lose a lot of pots because they crack and whatever.
Yeah.
And same thing with this gel plate thing. I had to do a dozen or more, it was a learning process. There was an extreme learning curve for me because I'd never done it before. I watched a couple of tutorials on YouTube, but I'd never heard of it.
Are they small format or larger format, these gel
I've
pieces?
Looked it up. What you can buy, I think the largest that I've seen what I was able to get 8x10.
Oh, so but small. I mean,
small,
relatively,
but
yeah,
you can make
right.
your own, and you can make them, 20x30 or whatever if you have a tray
make
big
them
enough.
In a brownie pan or something? Or,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So there
brownie
may be,
pan size.
There may be some larger that you can get commercially.
Yeah.
The ones if you make them yourself, I hear you have to after a while, it can just deteriorate.
Yeah.
But because it's gelatin, alcohol, and what else is in there? Water and, but the commercial ones are different. They're supposed to last years, mm-hmm. decades, if you take care of them. It's really an interesting technique, and I'm just learning myself.
Yeah, well, that's part of it, right? You're learning all the time. And Jessica, it was interesting to hear you talk about the process and your watercolors. Do you feel that – does that creep into your commercial work? Does the things that you do – or do you really kind of compartmentalize what you do when it comes to this artwork?
I think I compartmentalize, and usually I don't do – well, I honestly haven't watercolored in a while. I had a show two years ago at the museum. But our four-year-old loves my art supplies.
Oh, yeah. I'll bet.
So the watercolors don't usually stay out right now. So I haven't been able to watercolor, which is sort of why I wanted to sort of rework some of the pieces that I had loved that were numbered or not even reproduced, and just sort of wanted to play with them. And yeah, it is compartmentalized into totally separate. So it was kind of neat to just play with this one thing that I did one time that I thought I would never touch again, and the prints had sold, and that was that. And it's like thinking about the show, and I had drawn an image that was going to be totally different. I was going to go in a totally different direction for this. And
what were you going to
I was going to do what I had been doing with serigraphs, just like really bold colors, sort of like the poster print. I was going to go in that direction, and I will use it later for something. But it was sea lions on a buoy and one of the sea lions yelling. And I was like, I loved it, but I just like, kind of my brain got stuck. It's like, where else do I go from here? And then I was looking at a fish watercolor I had done, and I was like, I would like to do something with this. And I thought about just redrawing I did a series of all the five salmon heads and tails. And I was like, oh, I could redraw these and turn them into silk screens, and that would be interesting and kind of fun. Juno would like that. I don't know. And then I was like, well, what if I just do something totally new? And I was shopping for silk screen supplies for my business. And I was like, saw CMYK inks. And I was like, why don't I try this? And so it just sort of like in July, I was thinking I was doing something wildly different. And then by August, I was coding screens to do this totally different project. So
yeah, the inks I was going to ask about, how do you go about recreating the look of a watercolor using this silk screening process?
Yeah, it's a really specific silk print thing. don't know, do you know a lot about the history of CMYK printing? I think it was developed in like 1907. It was like figured out that out of cyan, magenta, yellow, and black, you can create any basically any color. And it's effectively what your printer does. In your printer, you're replacing cyan, you're replacing magenta, yellow, and black every time. So,
or even photographs.
It's the same thing. Right. From the dots and the way they overlap and the angles they overlap from that and those four colors, you can create any color on the color spectrum.
Yeah, right.
So it's really interesting. And then the halftone part, which are the dots, halftone. I think the history of halftone printing came out of necessity with newspapers, I think it was developed in 1907 or something, when photography became more mainstream and newspapers didn't want to use woodblock printing anymore and they wanted to use photographs. They had to figure out a way to print pictures, and they figured out that with dots they could create any gradient of a black and white photo. So it's effectively that, and so I'm doing that but with four colors.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember the wonder of being given a magnifying glass and told, look at that picture on the newspaper. It's all just little dots.
Yeah, I actually brought a magnifying glass for tonight.
So the dots in Europe is really, it's very much the same process. It's those kind of almost micro-sized dots.
Yeah, and with this, I blew them up more than you typically would, so that with just your eyes, you can see the dots. So
how do you create the dots on the screen?
So I separated my watercolors in the computer into the four colors. Like I had the computer do that for me. Photoshop.
Right.
So Photoshop was able to separate my watercolor into cyan, magenta, yellow, and black for me. So split those into four different images, and then was able to use a different process to turn it into dots. And then from there, I print each one. So each one onto a transparency.
Okay.
And then I have, at this point, already coated a screen in a photo emulsion in a dark room. So then from there, I attach the negative, which is the transparency, onto the silk screen. And then I put it in a light box and expose it for 1 minute. And then I wash it out with a power washer. And everywhere where on the transparency there's black washes away off the emulsion.
That's fascinating. Thank you for describing that, because that's one of those like little pieces of magic in between how an artist, that I never understood in this process didn't know that that's how. So it's basically each screen is essentially a photograph.
It is. Yeah.
Each has this
screen
relief.
Is the negative
of the different color representation.
And then when I silk screen it, I'm pulling ink through and creating the not negative.
Right.
The positive. Thank you.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, and it's fun, and I love it. And this was just like a really big challenge in the technical parts of what I do, and that's what was really fun for me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah,
Jim, where are you headed in your artwork right now? You've mentioned like what you're kind of presenting.
Well, where I'm headed, I'm teaching a printmaking workshop in January in Juneau.
And you said one of the other artists who's going to be presenting at this gallery was one of the people that you first worked with on printmaking.
Yes, I've worked with Charles Rohrbacher, who I would probably say is the most traditional artist of our group. But you have 10 people with 10 styles, I think almost 70 pieces of work. And framed pieces on the wall, and print ready to take away editions as well. So Christmas shoppers,
yes.
Open your eyes. Here we go.
It's good to mention that. Yes,
and
we should mention the other artists.
Yes,
I'll kind of run through them. And Rochelle Bonnet is one of them. Grace Corrigan, Gordon Harrison, Laura Maiko, David Riccio, who does awesome fractal computer work, Charles Rohrbacher, as you said, and Alice Terstig. So there's sort of a heavy hitting lineup there of Juno artists. These are names and artwork that a lot of people have seen through the years.
Well, we're excited about that. And Also excited that we have five new artists in the show this time around, Jessica being one of them. And it's a pretty vibrant community in Juneau for printmaking right now. It's also vibrant in Alaska. But yeah, it's really fun to, you know, it's not just the same cool kids all the time.
right. There's plenty of room in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
Well,
so
cool.
Come play.
Yeah. Well, it's all happening over at the Jack. Of course, it's part of Gallery Walk, which I'm going to, in a moment here, go through a little bit of a rundown of the huge roster of things to go to Gallery Walk. It's going to be a great night to walk around and go see from every part of town because it's going to be beautiful. Out tonight. So Alaska Inc., it's 10 Juneau printmakers, as we just said. It starts tonight. It runs all the way through December 29th. And thanks to you three for coming in. Congratulations on getting it to the show. That's always an accomplishment, right? You have the work hanging on the wall.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Wednesday was a good day.
Right.
Tomorrow's a good day.
Tomorrow's a better day. Yeah.
And Fumi Matsumoto, Jim Heumann, and Jessica Hanlon, thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations on the work that you've got going, and congratulations on the show that's going to be happening. It sounds like an awesome one and part of an amazing Gallery Walk that's going to be happening tonight. Thanks to all of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, it is Gallery Walk. Let's run through it a little bit here. This is just going to be a fast one here to run through because there's so much going on. But just so everyone knows kind of what's going on, again, from one end of town to the other is where really everything's happening. So over at Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, as we just covered, Alaska Inc. is happening. The Davis Gallery has Elaine Soltis Gray with art and hot tea bar. There's going to be happening over at the State Museum. There's Alaska Positive since 1970 and also the Friends of the State Museum. They're in the main kind of atrium area, are going to have Artist and Writer's Market with music by Dan Hobson. Juneau Douglas City Museum, this is going to be a great one. Definitely check out Bonnie Lynn Parker. She's an amazing ceramicist, and go check that work at the City Museum. Then over at Legislative Affairs Agency, Gallery Walk at the Capitol, Juneau Dance Theater, who we're going to talk to next, I won't give it away. We'll talk to them in just a moment. So Juneau Dance Theater premiering tonight as well. Marie Drake Planetarium has a planetarium open house. The Copa Cafe Gallery is going to be showing Jim Fowler, who always does such beautiful work. Downtown McGivney's Sports Bar and Grill, it's going to be Leave Her Wild AK Jewelry by Michaela Paff and Arbonne by Hannah Bibb. Cupcakes by Mandy and Tammy Tuesday Cocktails, which are really good. Real Juneau Home Group, which is over there in the Wharf Mall, is going to feature a good friend of mine, Jolene Smith, with Fringe and Fireweed. Really beautiful work that she does. Frost and Fur is going to be, that's Jessica Hanlon's, who we were just talking to. That's her operation. Anchorage Distillery is going to be pouring delicious drinks there. I'm going to be there pouring drinks with the CEO of Anchorage Distillery, John Blasco. So come visit us over at Frost and Fur in the Wharf. Alaska Knife Works, Unleash the Power of Friction Forge Technology, Diamond Blade Knives, all happening over at Alaska Knife Works. And Sea Alaska Heritage Institute has Sugar Bear Treasures, Ray Ann Mills, Tara Rodriguez, Caitlin Drake, Marion Roz Cruz of Naki Designs. That's all happening there at Sea Alaska. And then Sea Alaska Corporation has cookies, hot cider, and piano jazz in the lobby. The Downtown Business Association is going to have music by DJ Slay and performances. And then we've got Heritage Downtown Coffee, JoJo Briggs, and Santa Selfie Station. Drip Drop Wonder Shop, that's where Alaska Robotics used to be. That's going to have their Gallery Walk grand opening at the Drip Drop Wonder Shop. So go check that out. That's going to be really cool. Bustin' Out Boutique, Lindsay Burnett, ceramicist, is going to be there. There's going to be napkin art at the Triangle Bar. So go check that out. I don't know if that's, you know, like a gallery of napkin art or like just you go and create it, because everyone's done napkin art at one time. Am I right? So anyway, maybe that's what's going to be happening there. Find out at the Triangle Bar. Pottery Jungle. The Pottery Jungle pre-opening extravaganza is going to be happening, featuring artist Kay Hoke, and that's contemporary art. Lily Hope Weaver is going to have an exclusive Winterfire Raven's Tail earring collection. That's Lily Hope at 222 Seward Street. Then Northwind Architects always has great stuff happening on Gallery Walk, and it's going to be artwork by Harper Gunn and Lizzie Jergelit. Annie Kales is going to have Tom Crestedina. He's a visual artist. And then Southeast Alaska Land Trust is having a holiday wine pull. And we'll cover all the rest that's going on. There's a whole bunch more that I'll cover after we talk to Juno Dance Theater. And that's coming up in just a second. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein, your host for today. And we'll be right back with Juno Dance Theater to talk about the special holiday extravaganza coming up. Well, it is Christmas season here. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Andy Klein, and Bridget Lujan is joining us. She's the executive director of Juno Dance Theater. Bridget, it's an exciting but busy time of the year. Am I right?
You're so right. I'm going full steam ahead. Yeah, I'll be ready for a nap soon.
Yes, nap time comes after the new year. But it is. Without further ado, the Nutcracker starts tonight. I mean, starts in just a couple hours, right? Starts at 7 p.m. tonight, first performance.
We're ready to go. 7 p.m. tonight and tomorrow night, and then 2 p.m. tomorrow afternoon and Sunday afternoon. So we have a four-show run.
And did you have your dress rehearsal already?
Had dress rehearsal last night, and we had our student outreach this morning. We pushed 1,200 kids through the auditorium between Act 1 and Act 2 and the full performance.
Wow.
It was very well received.
And we were just talking, this is a mix between, of course, local people who get involved, especially the absolutely adorable children who are involved in this, and then incredible, basically world-renowned artists. So tell me a little bit about some of the people that some of these incredibly skilled people that have come in that you're excited about working with.
Yeah, for sure. So the cast breakdown, there's 93 in the cast. And
it's not that big. Yeah.
And
so you're going for the small scale of it.
Yeah, we go big or go home, as they say. So we
100 people. I mean, it's ridiculous.
For sure. Yeah, and some of the roles are double cast, and the girls are switching parts. And yeah, it's we try to give as many performing opportunities as we can to our students. But I'd say of the 93, so we're looking at 26 of them are advanced students. They're dancing in point shoes. And then maybe 75 or so are actually maybe 65, 75 are the younger kids, ages 5 through 8, 9, 10 years old.
Right.
And then we have the adult contingent. There are adult volunteers. They come in and do the party scene and the party parents. So there's 12 of them. And then we have our guest artists. We've got this year, Julia Rowe from the San Francisco Ballet coming to Juno. How cool is that? And she's bringing with her her cavalier is Ezra Thompson, and he is from Pacific Northwest Ballet. So two premier ballet companies, well-established guest artists coming to Juno to do the show. They're loving Juno, by the way.
You sent some preliminary pictures of dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
And it is one of those things when you see someone at that level. I don't know anything about ballet. But you just see someone at that level and you're like, that is amazing.
It's exquisite. It is incredible. Yeah.
I mean, number one, of course, is that thing of how do you even do that? Right. But then also just, as you say, just the beauty of the physical form of the dancer's form of the lines that they create. It's incredible.
And you know they're doing it right when it looks easy. But if you see them backstage, I mean, it's just a sweat fest and everybody. I mean, they are working so hard.
The level of technique
and experience it takes to do that, but with a smile and making it look so effortless
and beautiful. Tell me about what's the scuttlebutt among ballet artists on the Nutcracker? Is it something they love, or is it something they're like, okay, we got to do it again?
You know, I'm not really in the inner sanctum of all of that, but from what I can tell, everyone understands the purpose of the Nutcracker. It's the tradition. It's, for many companies, the Nutcracker proceeds carries them through the rest of their season. So, you do the big name tradition show that brings out the families and the big groups, and then maybe you have some extra cash to do something original and creative that maybe no one's going to go see.
Plus, it's an introduction to the art form for so many people. The Nutcracker must have been the first ballet for 80% of the people who are in ballet.
You're exactly right. It might be the first ballet they ever see live. It might be the first ballet they're ever in or get to participate in. Our own artistic director, who couldn't be here today, but he always tells the story of how he was in his first Nutcracker at age 2. Someone carried him around on stage and fed him milk and cookies, and he was happy as
could
be.
And he stole the show. Sure.
Right.
We were just talking. I have a friend who has 2 daughters in Nutcracker, and I saw she sent a picture of absolutely adorable. Ridiculous how adorable these kids are. But yeah, steal the show when they walk on, right?
Yeah. I remember when we were looking for costumes for the lambs, that was a new character added in 2015 with this leadership. Zach Hench is our artistic director. And I said, well, what do you want for in costumes? And he said, we want the audience to say, aw. Right. And that's exactly what happens when the lambs.
That costume is incredible. I saw that picture. I was like, that is the cutest lamb costume I've ever seen.
Oh, gosh. It's fun.
It's so fun to see that stuff. And I mean, I was actually incredibly impressed with the costuming. It is gorgeous, right? It's really beautiful.
It is. Yeah. I also happen to be the costume
person. I didn't even know that. There you go.
But I wouldn't say designer, but I, you know, have some input there. But we have most of the costumes in stock. Some of the costumes we've had since 2005, six, or, you know, the early years. I think the soldier costumes have been around for forever. We try to add to it. This year we are debuting new costumes for the tea variation. In a lot of companies, it might still be known as Chinese tea. We kind of ditched that association, and we have a new theme. They're tea fairies. They spill the tea. They're just adorable. And so we have brand new tutus and costumes for that group this year. We're excited to debut those. We try to add 2 things, to the wardrobe over the years. And of course, you have to guess on sizes.
Let me ask you that now. Maybe Nutcracker's a little bit different, but I wasn't aware that there was that level of kind of improvisation or changing with these traditional works.
Yeah. Any choreographer that comes along can do what they want with it to a classical piece like this. And George Balanchine is one of the more famous versions. There's when you hear a Balanchine company, that's New York City Ballet, that's Pacific Northwest Ballet, Miami City Ballet, I think. There's others that do that version. So you see certain flagship elements within the Nutcracker, the different versions, but there's many, many, many choreographers out there who put their own spin on things. They change the characters, just the way, you know, different Claras, different approaches to the story. So yeah, from company to company, you'll see differences, and it's fun. If you're a fan of the Nutcracker, seeing it performed by different companies is really fun because you can compare.
Ask you, this is dumb guy new to ballet asking the question. So Tchaikovsky writes Nutcracker, right? Mm-hmm. Does he work with an original choreographer, or does he just write a piece of work saying with general direction about what he thinks is happening in the story, or how does that work?
The children's book, I think, is it E.T.A. Hoffman is the author? I might have gotten that wrong,
maybe.
But this is where we need Zach. And
yes.
I can tell you all about the financials and the compliance.
I'll put you on the spot, I know.
No, that's okay. I believe the story came first. I don't know if Tchaikovsky wrote the music with the ballet in mind or who the original choreographer was. I'm sorry, I'm going to come up empty on that.
How about with contemporary ballets or contemporary work? Or how does it typically work?
It depends. Often you have you commission a choreographer and you commission the composer and you throw them in a room together. If you know Todd Hunt, he was part of a process and I think that was what happened. You write this, I write that, and let's get together. When we performed Snow White last year, that was another situation where the composer was commissioned separately from the choreographer and they collaborate. So usually the music comes first and the choreographer works with the music, but I have seen it go the other way.
And then the choreography isn't canon, sort of, or it's like it's the start, but there can be variations on that. Or someone can come along as a new choreographer and say, I'm going to reinterpret this thing in a way it's never been done before.
It's intellectual property. You know, choreography is so it's protected just like any other intangible work, or it should be anyway. And so to perform that choreography, our Nutcracker belongs to Zachary Hench, our artistic director. It's his choreography. And so someone else to perform the exact the exact pieces the way he choreographed it would, you know, probably not be pretty cool.
I'm sure someone in the audience right now is just yelling that I'm an idiot, but I just never put that together that that's how ballet worked. You know, I just have gone and watched. I don't know enough to know that a scene has changed, you know, because of a choreographer is different.
Right.
But it's fascinating to think about that.
It is.
That obviously choreographers and the famous ones we know and can list, you know, have interpreted these things in ways that are revolutionary and are unique to them in the same way that someone writes a song and that's unique
to them. Exactly. Yeah. And with ballet, there's hot choreographers right now. There's ones that are the choreographers. Christopher Wheeldon comes to mind. He won a Tony Award for An American in Paris, but he's been choreographing for New York City Ballet for years and years and years. So, you know, it kind of just depends on what's sexy for the moment.
And
those choreographers get real popular and their works, then they become really expensive to commission. So,
that's how it goes. Well, the Nutcracker, starting tonight, and JunoDance.org is a place people can go and get tickets.
Yes,
right?
That's right. Tickets are available right up to the show time if you want to get them online. They will be available at the door, but it's reserved seating. So I like your chances. You might like your chances better by getting your tickets in advance.
Especially this opening night, first weekend, couple of weekends, stuff like that. Yeah. How long is it running? Is it just 2 weekends?
No, it's just the one weekend.
Just this weekend.
Yeah,
this is it.
You've got 4 shows and that's it. And, you know, 2 evening shows and 2 matinees. And then we also have, you know, with the matinee shows, we've got the Land of Sweets Tea and Tour. That's kind of an add-on. You come early. It's a premium ticket that comes with a craft, a gourmet snack, a photo on stage after. The snacks are so good. I go for the food. But, we've got groups that come dressed up. They wear their tiara. They sit in the VIP seats down front center. So that's the Land of Sweets Tea and Tour. And that's available as a separate ticket that includes admission to the ballet, but it's a separate ticket for Saturday. It's sold out for Sunday, but there are still Land of Sweets tickets available
for Saturday.
Well,
that sounds pretty awesome.
It's fun.
Why not do it up if you're going to go to
Nutcracker?
Oh, yeah.
There's a candy bar. You know, you go through the candy bar and fill up your little baggie. Yeah, it's pretty cool. You hear the story. They read the story of the Nutcracker, as a matter of fact. So you could come to the Land of Sweets, Andy, and hear the story where it all started.
Right. Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, well, that's an amazing, that's kind of your VIP ticket thing.
Yeah.
And then it's happening, of course, it's at JDHS.
Right.
It's at the auditorium. So beautiful, you know, great as far as the
Got the proscenium stage and the scenery. I think, you know, look for bright colors and the vibrance of the scenery and the costumes is just makes it completes the piece. But of course, our guest artists are the feature. The caliber of that talent in every day.
Yeah, no, that's really exciting. What else is happening with Juno Dance? We got the Nutcracker, but now kind of happening with
We're so busy. Right on the heels of Nutcracker, I'll probably be in here again to talk about Juno's Got Talent. That's coming up February 3rd. We have auditions December 16th and 17th. We've got a winter showcase that features our dance team and our adult students and some of our recreational classes. That's coming in January 13th and 14th. And then we have a spring showcase with a very exciting, but I'm not allowed to announce it yet, very exciting story ballet will be part of the spring showcase, much like we did Snow White and Carnival of the Animals. This is the next thing that I can't say, but soon we'll be making that announcement.
Yeah,
that's in April. That's
spring,
April, right around the tax deadline, I think. April 19, 20, and 21.
Making it a busy week for you.
Right. We're just going nonstop. We have 160 year-round students. Registration for spring semester will be coming up probably towards the middle to the end of the month of December. We'll open registration for spring semester, and then we're off and running again. I mean, just go, go, go.
Sounds great, though. What a great contribution it makes to Juno and, you know, performing arts in Juno.
Thank you very much.
You know, it feels like sometimes the dance part of performing arts is like the one that somehow doesn't get the attention that it should. It takes so many resources, and it takes so much training, you know, and so much work to get to the level where you can put on a performance.
Yes,
Plus, it requires the music and it requires the stage and the sets and all the other things that any other performance art requires.
It always amazes me. I mean, as long as we've been, we're going into our 50th year, Juno Dance Theater has been around, and still the folks in Juno, you know, they don't necessarily know who we are or what we do or that what there's classical ballet training here in Juno. Who knew that?
And that's true. I think that sometimes, I mean, even if you're aware that there's a ballet that gets performed, the idea that there's also training or classes or ways you could get involved doesn't connect necessarily.
Just last week, someone said, I always thought the high school did the Nutcrackers.
Like,
and that makes total sense because that's down at the high school. But we're doing a lot. We've got kids, some of our more serious, dedicated dancers. You're just like with any sport or activity or something that you decide you're going to commit to. This is your thing. You know, it's dollars and it's hours in the studio and it's a lot of sacrifices. We've got two graduating seniors this year and, you know, I don't know how much they're out with their friends and going to parties and dances they committed early on. This is what we're going to do. They try to do, you know, and they're just, they're dedicated. It takes a lot. And especially because we're not affiliated with a school, you're kind of a little bit detached. So
and you have to, you're responsible for all your own fundraising, all that stuff. So that's, it's a lot of work. I know you do a lot of work, Bridget, and it's appreciated. Well, the Nutcracker starts tonight.
Yay.
First performance is at 7 p.m. tonight. There's two performances tomorrow, Sunday, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. And then there's a matinee 2 p.m. performance on Sunday. And that's it. Four performances of the Nutcracker. Just from the photos I've seen, and we'll share it, a few of those photos as well online on the KTOA website. It's fantastic. Kids are cute as can be. I mean, give me a break. And of course, incredible international talent that's here, which is incredibly exciting that you were able to bring in and attract that kind of talent from the San Francisco Ballet. So, Bridget, congratulations on pulling off another Nutcracker.
Thank you.
Break a leg tonight or have everyone there. All that. And it's the Nutcracker, and you can find it all on junodance.org. Thanks again, Bridget, for coming in. We appreciate it. Okay. Well, it is Gallery Walk. A few more things to mention for Gallery Walk. There's Willow and Luna happening. Christine Carpenter, who does wonderful work. We just bought some of her work. I just bought some of her stuff from the public market, and she's with Lays Studio, and Carly Thayer of Bering Sea Designs. They're going to be at Willow and Luna. The Rookery Cafe will have C.J. Harrell as an artist there. Shoofly Alaska, Hannah Mitchell, metals artist. Barnaby Brewing has Lavender Peaks Photography. Susan and Natalie Watson Studio and Gallery. It's going to be an open studio. Rainbow Foods has new colorful oil paintings by Juno artist Paige Bridges. Also, Lodestone Library. Laura Brown has some beautiful work there. Lodestone Library, can't recommend it enough. Laura Brown's work is fantastic. It's mixed media. And also the Lodestone Library soft launch is happening tonight. Spice Cafe and Art Gallery is going to have M.K. McNaughton, another fantastic artist. Patty Hutchins, Jupy, and live music. Also, Spice Juno Indian Cuisine is going to have live music by local musician Isaiah Unziker. Treetop Teas, Treetop Tea Treats and Raffle happening there. Devil's Club Brewing has Maddie Combrink. And Mount Juno Trading Post has George Gress, guitar maker. Beautiful work from George Gress. Chilcat Trading also as well. And then Juno's Imagination Station is going to have Linda Buckley. Indigenous Art, Doug Chilton Designs is going to be happening as well at 174 South Franklin Street. Then Harbor Tea and Spice has Jeremy Kane, who's a ceramicist. Juno Artist Gallery, Neil McConaughey is going to be there with fused glass. Alaskan Brewing at the Depot Stores has some hors d'oeuvres and a drawing happening. Red Dog Calf Saloon has High Cost of Living playing tonight. Oh boy, that's happening down at the Red Dog. Gary's Fine Jewelry Gallery Walk is also happening at theirs as well. And Caribou Crossings has Lisa McCormick, Kodiak Island Silversmith. Trove has Gallery Walk kickoff happening as well. Taku Fisheries is going to have some smoked salmon and a wine tasting. And tonight is also the opening night for Perseverance Theater's A Nice Indian Boy. And so that is happening as well tonight. A Perseverance Theater, all happening at Gallery Walk. It's a great night to walk around Juneau and enjoy everything Juneau has to offer. And that's going to do it for Juneau Afternoon, broadcast live on KTOO 104.3 FM, online at kto.org, and rebroadcast on this station at 7 o'clock. For more info on the show or to listen to past shows, you can go to kto.org/JunoAfternoon. Boston Christopher is our producer. We had help today from Aaron Tripp as well, and our theme music is by Indian Agent. I'm Andy Klein. Thanks for listening.